I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. Now to a story of violence, hope, and redemption. James McBride's new novel, Song Yet Sung, is a semi-fictional account of slavery set in pre-Civil War Maryland. The story centers around a runaway slave and a determined slave catcher. But the book does more than tackle issues of race. McBride raises larger questions about the legacy of slavery and what it means to be human. NPR's Farai Today recently caught up with McBride, who described two of the main characters, both of them strong women with very different lives.
Well, Liz Spokot is a very beautiful 19-year-old black woman who dreams of the future. And the future that she dreams of, the African-American race, is very bleak. She dreams of young men driving around in motor carriages with music booming throughout, singing songs of murder and so forth, and fat black children who run from books like they're poison. And so she becomes known as the dreamer, and these dreams that she has are both troubling and enlightening for her because she dreams of a song yet sung that is supposed to lead her and others to freedom. The other main character is Patty Cannon, who is based on a real character named Patty Cannon, who was a slave stealer in the southern Delaware, Maryland, Eastern Shore area. And Patty Cannon is a very beautiful, handsome woman who has a gang of white and black slave stealers who steal slaves and sells them south. And Patty Cannon is trying to catch Liz Spokot because Liz escaped from Patty the first time.
In fact, you have a complicated situation where, as part of her enterprise, she will have, as you mentioned, black henchmen who are with her at all times. What was it like to get into this space where you could portray not just slave and free, but also these nuances of allegiances?
Well, I'm a little embarrassed to confess that it wasn't that hard to get into Cannon's head or into the head of her henchmen because people were starving, people were hungry, and people would do a lot for money, irrespective of how it affects others.
Now, you have scenes of violence, combat, brutality. At one point near the end of the book, you say simply, it was all hands and teeth now. You say it wasn't that hard to get into the mindset of, you know, the struggles that people throughout humanity have had. What was it like to write combat scenes?
It was not easy. The combat scenes that you speak of involve a character named the Woolman, who was a black slave who lives out in the woods, and who even black people are afraid of. And he lives free, and he ends up fighting Patty Cannon and others to try to free his son who's been captured. And those scenes were difficult to do, partly because the Woolman, although he is a kind of a wild person, he's basically a shy man who is afraid of people. And I've never written about violence in a way that, you know, that is superfluous or meaningless. These battle scenes, these fight scenes had to take place in order for the characters to free themselves of the inner and outer demons that plagued them.
Why do you have so many strong and differentiated female characters? I mean, in your memoir, you also are telling a woman's story. Why do you seem to gravitate towards female characters?
Listen, I was raised by a strong woman. And also, women have the kind of emotional makeup that men don't have, in that, without generalizing, but at least in my life, I've seen women take the kind of emotional hits that would shatter men into a million pieces. Women simply get up off the canvas and they come back at you again and again. Not necessarily with fists, but with a will and a determination and a sense of desire and boldness and courage that sometimes men just can't drum up. I mean, men, it's, you know, it's a kind of a testosterone element, you know, blah, you know. But women, they just seem to be stronger. They have a lot more emotional business that you can manipulate as a writer, and they're deeper, and also they're not spoken for in this context of historical novels. Historically, women have done so much more and are a lot more interesting to deal with, rather than the Jesse Jameses and the John Waynes and so forth that we've become used to mythologizing.
What about the code? You have this running theme of signs and symbols that enslaved people can show to each other in different ways, clothing and items that are hung from trees and all sorts of lines drawn in the dirt. How much of that comes from research and how much of that is something that you invented to hold this story together?
I don't know. A lot of it is real. When I went to Oberlin Conservatory, and one of the first classes I took was an African-American music history course. And anyone who's taken an African-American music history course from anyone who knows what they're doing will see that a lot of what was handed down historically in terms of black history musically has to do with the messages that people gave each other through the music. So in terms of the codes, I think the music is quite evident that the codes existed, at least in terms of the music. In terms of the other things, quilt signs that were made on quilts, blacksmithing, blacksmith hammering at certain tempos and times and so forth, I think some of that existed. How much of it, I don't know. You know, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, they never told, they never revealed how they got free. In fact, Frederick Douglass, he criticized those like Henry Box Brown and so forth, the guy who shipped himself north in a box. He criticized those people for telling folks how they got free because he knew there were millions of others who were trying still to get free. I don't think the codes were like a book, like, you know, an army manual of this was the code. But I think in certain regions, in certain areas, there's no question that there were codes, unwritten codes that were used by those who worked the trade. I think the codes were used. How much? I don't know. I mean, some of the business I cooked up on my own, but most of it I found from other places.
You have a physical space where you write and you also perform, practice your music. What is it about being a musician that also stimulates you, and what different flavor does it bring to your life than writing?
Well, I have a little spot in Manhattan, Manhattan's Hell's Kitchen, that I've been going to for years that I share with a guy who fixes saxophones. And I go in and chat. When the musicians are different, they like to talk. They're a little bit like journalists. They're like cheap intellectuals. They know a little bit
about
everything. That's
right. That's right. I'll take my tinfoil hat and put it on.
So, I mean, the camaraderie of music and being with musicians, and the collaborative process that is involved in the music process is something that helps me as a writer and as a screenwriter. Because even to write a book like Song Yek Sung, you have to interview dozens of people. You have to involve people in the collaborative process so you won't get the material that you need that will make your story go. And so music gives you that. It helps you understand that you're part of a bigger song. You're just a member of the band.
Someone once told me that creative people are cursed because there's never an end. If you're a creative person, there's always a next, another idea. What's the worst part to you about doing what you do?
Probably having to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning because you heard someone say something and you need to write it down, or you get an idea, you need to write it down. Also, the notion that this is easy work. And also you become a target. You go from being a nobody to being somebody that people think, you know, they think you're rich, they want to borrow money. They don't really understand that, you know, that you're still competing, that you're still trying to be, you know, a viable artist, and you're still trying to say something that's important. And you're trying not to tell the same joke twice artistically. So you have to kind of shut yourself off from the world a little bit. And that hurts you artistically a little bit.
Well, on that note, James McBride, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Writer and musician James McBride speaking with NPR's Farah Chidea. His latest book is Song Yet Sung. You can hear James read from his new novel at our website, nprnewsandnotes.org.